All right, let's take a look at our outline real quick, our text, actually, and find out. Marcy had mentioned, and I can't remember. Let's see. How far did I get? Verse 2? Okay. Okay, we're at verse 2. The other thing is, here's a spoon left over from the potluck. Does that belong to anybody present here? All right. And then I had mentioned a couple of times the chronological Bible. And if somebody wants this one, they're welcome to it. I picked this up at a thrift store this past week. This is the King James Version, but it's arranged chronologically. It's written in chronological order. The whole Bible's here, but it's split up as far as chronology is concerned.
No, I'd like to look at it.
You'd like to look at it.
If no one wants it, I'd look at it.
All right.
I've never seen one like that. I just
said. No, it actually, well, it starts with Genesis because it's dealing with not necessarily the order in which they were written, but the order in which the events are. It might. I think it might. It might have John 1:1, for example, at the very beginning. I've read one before. I've got one at home, but it's been a little while. I can't remember the exact, but it's arranged chronological. And it's kind of funny because you'll be reading along, and all of a sudden there'll be a chapter of one of the prophets, and you'll be reading along, and all of a sudden, and so the prophets, many of the prophets, along with Kings and Chronicles, are mingled as you go through the text. I mean, it's clearly differentiated as far as what you're reading. They'll have, you know, a section or a chapter or even just a few verses together. Yes?
Are there differences between one publisher and another as far as the order of the verses or whatever they do? Or?
No. Okay. Like I said, this is a chronological Bible.
I mean, if some other publisher published it, would he jump to a different verse?
It's been revised a couple of times. This was done actually by a fundamental Baptist back in the 70s. And it's been reprinted a bunch of times. It's still in print. But it's been redone sometime in the last 8-10 years. And I haven't seen a newer copy. And I think it's available in other versions now. But it was originally done by a fundamental Baptist. All right. We are in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Thank you. And in verse 2. I didn't get past that? Oh, that's because I'm dealing with Sabbatarianism and the digressions there. All right. Very quickly, next it says as far as sending along messengers and whoever they'll designate. Here we go. Here's my copy. Whoever they'll designate to go with him. It says in verse 3, and when I come to Corinth, He's in Ephesus as he writes this. So he's across the Aegean. As the crow flies, it's not real far, but if you're gonna, you know, you gotta take a ship or you go for a long walk. By the way, if you do a Google, map on how to get, and with directions, and type in Hawaii from here, it'll give you directions to the coast and then tell you to get in a kayak. All right, verse 3. So he would have to get in his kayak to go across the Aegean or walk around the long way. When I come, whomsoever ye shall approve by your letters of recommendation, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. And if it is meet or appropriate that I go also, they shall go with me. Paul, and we'll see this. This is when he got arrested, by the way. This is he's planning on going to Jerusalem. He had agreed with the folks there in Jerusalem. We talked about the poverty of the people there in Jerusalem, what the special need they had. You had probably somewhere around 10% of the city of Jerusalem that were actually born-again believers. A huge number of people had gotten saved in the previous decade and a half. And they were socially ostracized. They were still living as Jews. They were still keeping all the dietary regulations. They were still observing the Sabbath. They were doing all the cultural practices of Judaism, so they fit in with the culture. in part because that's the culture they grew up with, and the other part is it makes it much easier to reach out to the community. If you don't want to do something that is offensive to the people you're trying to reach. If you had a church in Brooklyn, New York, for example, and you're trying to reach out to the Jewish community, and by the way, New York City has almost as many Jews as the country of Israel. Probably half of the United States Jewish population lives in the metro New York City area. When Aaron and I were in Israel, we went to Tiberias in Galilee, and there was a diamond shop. And the Jews have dominated diamond cutting for centuries, actually. And so there was a wholesaler place, and we could go through this big, huge showroom that was probably double the size of this room, just thousands and thousands of diamonds. And the young lady, she was in her 20s, who was talking to us about the diamonds and explaining the various cuts and the sheen and how they glittered depending on the lighting. And the various calibers and the carats and all this other stuff. She was talking to us like this, and I talked to her afterward, and I said, "Are you from New York?" And she says, "No, but my parents are." Is that where you learn to speak English? So anyway, you had about 10% of the population there in Jerusalem that were born-again believers, but they were ostracized culturally. If you were a laborer, I think I went into this a little bit. You weren't hired. If you had a business, the average person would not cater your business if they knew that you were a believer. And so, the believers were poverty stricken. You had a few people that had means and so on, but this is also one of the reasons why it was necessary, and this is where the premise comes in the New Testament, as far as those who are able to give to help out those who are in need, is particularly among fellow believers. And so Paul had agreed to do this while he was out and about and ministering in the Gentile world, that the Gentile churches, the predominantly Gentile churches, they were all mixed at this time, the predominantly Gentile churches would take up offerings from time to time and send them to Jerusalem. Now, these days, you can sit at your computer and do this and send money. It's amazing. It's magic. All right? Could you do a wire transfer in the first century?
No.
Could you send a check?
No.
Did they have letters of credit? Yes, sort of. But you had to be somebody. You had to be a well-known character in order to be able to pull something like that off. If you're your average person, you didn't have access to even something like that. So here Paul is in, he's ministering in Ephesus. They're going to take collections throughout what is now Turkey in Galatia and so on. We're going to see that in just a little bit. Or we saw that last time. He had given instructions to the churches in Asia and said, "So I want you to do this thing on the first day of the week." So he's taking collections in Asia Minor, in Turkey, what is now Turkey. He is going to be taking collections in Macedonia and Achaia, which is Greece today. He's taking collections in that area, the areas of his ministry. The various churches are going to take up, have been taking up collections. So when Paul passes through, they've got it all ready to go. He's not having to linger, wait for the church to gather together so they can make a contribution. It's all done. He'll go through this whole area, and he's going to have the money. Now, why does he say, "When I come, whomsoever you shall approve by letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem"? Why don't they just say, why don't you just give it to me and I'll take it? There's three reasons.
One, safety in numbers.
Okay, safety in numbers. All right. If I'm going to go from here to, you know, San Francisco, even something that close, and I'm carrying cash, lots and lots and lots of cash, you don't want to just send one person for several reasons. One is the security aspect of it. Okay, I'm going to be talking this morning in the morning service about thieves breaking through and stealing. Okay, that'll be part of what we're going to be talking about this morning. So for security purposes, you're going to want others to go along. What else?
So they couldn't accuse him of...
Okay, accountability. Same reason why here at Grace Baptist Church, all the checks that the church sends out, whether my paycheck or to pay for the bills and various things that we have, all require two signatures. It is an accountability thing. All right. So others would go, so Paul couldn't be accused of pilfering, even if, you know, he's impeccably honest. He's not a guy that's interested in lining his pockets. But to prevent rumors, you want to make sure that everything is above board, that there's no question as far as that is concerned. Why else? I'm suffering from the same thing that I think many other people are suffering from, in that all I've got in my wallet are receipts. I don't have, do you want them now? Here. There you go. I don't have anything in my wallet as far as I have one of these. Once in a while, I have some money, some actual money, but not very often. When we deal with cash, we deal with pieces of paper. If you were dealing with cash 2,000 years ago, what did you have?
Coins.
They were made of various metals, and if you're dealing with large quantities of cash, you would have it in the higher denominations, and it would be principally silver, although sometimes occasionally gold. All right? This stuff's heavy. Can I use you as an illustration? All right. When Leo took his graceful fall, and I went with him 2 days to tend his machines. I'll tell you what, sacks of quarters are heavy. Are heavy.
Only 50 pounds.
50 pounds. Okay, you get one in each hand. Or I was carrying, I think, two in one hand. No, I couldn't do that. It was one in each hand. And I don't want to compress my vertebrae. That's heavy. All right. These churches have been gathering up funds, and it's silver. So you're probably dealing with comparable weight, hundreds of pounds, literally hundreds of pounds of silver and gold. So you need it because security, because everybody knows what you've got because it's heavy. And you need porters to carry the stuff. It's heavy to move money. And they didn't have, you know, you couldn't put it in a bill or a check or, a money order or whatever. You had to take the cash. And so Paul is going to need a number of people to go with him for security, for accountability, and also just to carry the stuff because it's heavy. So that's the plan. They're going to have letters. Yes. And yes, those who have come from Corinth or Ephesus or Pisidian Antioch or whatever the case may be, they're going to go to Jerusalem. They're going to meet the saints that are there. They're going to meet the apostles. They're going to meet the Christians that are there in Jerusalem. And then they're going to go back home, and they'll be able to report what's going on back there. This is one of the reasons why missionaries come home. This is one of the reasons why missionaries come home every few years. One is for a break, although some of them would prefer to stay back on the field. They really would. But they come home. The other reason is so that they can come and report. Tell the folks what's going on face to face. Not just letters or emails or telephone calls, but they can report face to face as far as things that they have seen and done. Now, Paul's personal plans, what he is going to be doing, what his hopes are. And by the way, this is pretty much how it came about. It says in verse 5, now I will come unto you when I pass through Macedonia, for I do pass through Macedonia. He's not going to take a boat across the Aegean. He's going to go up and over the top. All right, and I didn't bring my maps this time. And I'm not going to try I'll go ahead and do this. All right, you got Turkey. Okay, Jerusalem is down here. You've got a bunch of little islands over here. You've got, you know, all these little islands along here. Some of them Rhodes and Patmos, and you got Cyprus down here. And then you've got Greece. Okay? Isn't that great? You got the idea? Okay, Corinth is here. Paul is writing from here. So instead of taking a boat across, he is going to hoof it around the top. Now, why? It would be faster to take a ship. It'd be probably three or four times faster. Why is he going the Land route. Exactly. There are churches all along there. And he's going through there. He's going to, number one, he's collecting the offerings. And number two, he is checking up on the churches that he's been involved in starting. So he's going to pass through there. This area up here, that's Macedonia. That's where Philippi is. That's where Thessalonica is. So he's going to pass through Macedonia on his way to this region down here is called Achaia. And so he's going to pass through Macedonia on his way to Achaia, which is where Corinth is. So when I shall pass through Macedonia, for I do pass through Macedonia, verse 6, and it shall be that I shall abide, yea, and winter with you, that ye may bring me on my journey whithersoever I go. I know a couple of you, a few of you, have traveled to that part of the world, this part of the world here. When Aaron and I went, we were there in March, and it was an odd year. The what normally quit very end of February, beginning of March, had continued on in large part while we were there. And so you've got a climate. We have an odd climate here. Did you know that? We have an odd climate here. We have a combination maritime and Mediterranean climate. And we have a dry season and a wet season. In the Mediterranean, it's a dry season and a wet season. And in the wintertime, you didn't travel unless you had to. The ships did not go from October-ish until March. Ships didn't go to sea. They would find some port, and they'd stay put. They didn't go anywhere because you had, well, you know what it's like here when we have the winds and all that stuff. Can you imagine going out there in a 150-foot sailing ship trying to navigate some of this stuff without the benefit of steam power or coal or, you know, some kind of motor or something to govern the thing? You're at the whim of the winds. Well, you have the same kind of thing there. They have similar stuff. Not so much in the Mediterranean. Well, they have the same kind of storms we get here. It's not a hurricane. Yeah, but we get some serious winds out here. Which, like I said, you want to be, you know, in Gray's Harbor when we have, you know, one of our winter storms in a sailing ship. No. All right. So they didn't travel in the wintertime, and because they didn't have satellite, they didn't have all those communications. Right? So you don't know how fast a storm is going to come. I mean, read Acts 27. You'll find out what this is all about. You know, Paul's shipwreck and so on. Yes?
Mediterranean has had some very serious storms. I was in one of them.
Yeah, they get some pretty serious stuff. Just because it's a smaller body of water does not mean that you can't get some serious stuff. I mean, I'm from Michigan, and some of the storms they've had on the Great Lakes, I mean, you might be familiar with the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, where you had a freighter that was about 100 yards long, and it was picked up on two waves out of the water, snapped in the middle, and sunk on Lake Superior in November. You get some serious stuff with, you know, 70, 80-foot waves. So they didn't travel that way. In part, and part of it is, you know, you're dealing with you know, fairly high mountains in parts of this. Just like if you used to live in Colorado, very sudden changes in weather. You got the winds coming off the mountains and then dropping down on the plain, and you get some serious stuff here. So anyway, they didn't travel. So if he's going to leave here, and he's wanting to be in Jerusalem during Pentecost, end of May, beginning of June. All right. So he's planning on being in Jerusalem at Pentecost. So he's planning to winter here in Corinth. So he's going to be leaving here. He's going to make this round and spend some time along here. He's going to be leaving here probably mid to late summer. And working, taking a couple of months to work his way down here, spend a number of months here in Corinth. And then we'll find, if you go through and see the record in the book of the Acts, Paul continued his journey and went down to Jerusalem as planned. But you get the idea of the timetable. He's going to leave here midsummer, travel across through here, hitting the various churches, spend the winter in Corinth, and then when shipping begins again, he's going to head back to Jerusalem in time to be there for Pentecost. So he's going to spend the winter there in Corinth, verse 7. For I will not see you now by the way, but I trust to tarry a while with you if the Lord permits. So he's, instead of coming right away, he's gonna take care of some other things. He's gonna stay where he is in Ephesus and then, stay in Corinth at this time because he wants to spend some time there. Why does Paul want to particularly spend some time in Corinth? Two reasons. Help me out. Yeah, I mean, we've gone through this book. And they've got this issue and this issue and this issue. And most of them are behavioral, although some of them are tied to theology. And then chapter 15, they had some theological problems. So he wants to go there to hopefully deal with some of their issues. Okay, why else? Why else does he want to go to Corinth? Yeah, I mean, well, he started a lot of these, but he if you go through the book of the Acts, you'll find that Paul... And he had a large team. When we get toward the third missionary journey and stuff, probably Paul had 25 or 30 people that were working in his with him in ministry. So as he's traveling through a place, hits all these various places along the way, stops, preaches the gospel, wins a bunch of people to Christ, and then he says, okay, Timothy, Luke, Epaphroditus, Tychicus, Titus, I'm going to take you, and you're going to go to this town. You, you're going to go to this town. You, you're going to go to this town. And he would take them and put them in those various places, and they would stay there for a number of months, maybe 6 months or even a year. And they would organize the church. They would teach the disciples. They would get them trained, and then eventually turn the work over to somebody who was from that community, just like how missions operates today. Paul was doing this, you know, 2,000 years ago. So he had the team to do this, but there was two places where Paul himself spent a lot of time. Instead of constantly moving, he stayed in two places for a while. He was in Ephesus for 3 years. For 3 years he was here. In Corinth, he was there for a year and a half. So he had a special connection with Ephesus and a special connection with Corinth. And so and he knows the people there in Corinth. They're not just believers that he's met along the way and remembers a few names and the folks that were there. He knows those people. He knows the situation. He lived there for a year and a half. He ministered to those people. And therefore, he's got a personal connection with Corinth as well. So that's one of the reasons I believe he was going to want to spend the winter there. And almost certainly did. But, he says in verse 8, I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost. All right, until early summer. For a great door and effectual is opened unto me. And, or but, would probably be a better translation because it's the same word in the Greek. There are many adversaries. Paul had a phenomenal ministry in Ephesus. Ephesus was one of the largest cities in the Roman Empire. It was in the top six. Had a great location as far as, because you got Italy over here. You've got Greece here. And then you've got Egypt down over here where the carpet is, and Syria over here. And so if you're going to go from Italy and Greece, you're going to pass by, because the ships did not cut across open water. They didn't have a compass. They stayed pretty much within sight of land. So they're going to come through here. Ephesus was a major stopping point. It was a major center for commerce. And so all kinds of people were coming and going. Corinth was too, by the way. All kinds of people coming and going. And it says in the book of the Acts that when Paul was ministering here in Ephesus, the whole province of Asia, all of Asia, that would be that whole region there, heard the gospel. Did Paul travel to the outlying cities? Probably not. It wasn't necessary. He sent other members of his team or people who had come to know Christ when they came to Ephesus for business or whatever, came. They were there for a while. They may have been there for a number of months. Remember, travel was not easy. So if somebody came, they weren't going to just, you know, turn around after a two-day trip. They were going to be there for a number of weeks or maybe even months. They came. They got saved. They were taught. They were discipled. They took the gospel back home. You read the book of Colossians. Paul had never been to Colossae. Paul had never been there. He knew about them. He prayed for them. He knew some people from there. He had never been there. And Colossae is up there. So he had a great ministry here in the province of Asia, principally here in the city of Ephesus, but there were many adversaries. What happened at the end of Paul's 3 years in Ephesus? He left of his own accord. But under a lot of encouragement that it was for his own benefit to leave. But he was told to leave not by the authorities, but by the believers. Why? What happened?
Is this where they were trying to teach the Jews and Gentiles and they were not accepting?
No, that wasn't it. This is a big, big, big thing. Do you remember the riot in Ephesus? Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Oh, yeah. And they had a citywide riot as a result of the ministry of the gospel there in the city of Ephesus. Lots of opposition. Yeah, you read about the seven wonders of the world. Okay? There were seven wonders of the ancient world. By the way, out of the seven wonders of the ancient world, there's only one of them still around. What is it? There's one still around. The pyramids. Pyramids. All right. One of the seven wonders of the ancient world was the temple of Diana of the Ephesians. And by the way, it's been in my lifetime, I think, that maybe a little bit earlier than that they've discovered it. They looked for this thing for a long, long time, looked for the ruins of it. They couldn't find it. And they could read descriptions of it. The ancient writers described the thing. It was as big as a football field. It was huge. By the way, if you go to Greece, the Parthenon is a lot bigger than you imagine it to be. It's big. You could play full court basketball inside of it if you could. I mean, if it was arranged such. But it was an enormous building. Big, huge columns, you know, built like the Parthenon, similar type structure. Gorgeous thing. Big, huge, monstrous thing. They finally found it. It was built on a swamp. And because it's made of stone over the centuries, blub, 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 blub. It sunk. And of course, after the fall of paganism, they took a lot of the building materials, a lot of the temples and stuff were dismantled, and they took the marble and stuff and built other things out of it. So, anyway, it was a major center for paganism. People used to come from all over the Roman world to worship and take pilgrimages to the temple there in Ephesus. And so there was a lot of opposition from the pagan leadership and also from the silversmiths that sold the little shrines. Aaron and I were in New York City a year and a half ago. And if you're in New York City, what do you buy at the little gift shops? Little Statues of Liberty. You come to Seattle, what do you buy? Little Space Needles. You go to Paris, you buy little Eiffel Towers. You go to London, you buy a little Big Ben's, all right? They have these things everywhere, all right? You go to Ephesus, you buy little shrines that are the temple of Diana the Ephesians. And the silversmiths made a killing selling these little things made out of silver. And Paul and his company were so effective in preaching the gospel, and people were leaving paganism by the drove, that the silversmiths were the ones that instigated the riot there in Ephesus because it was hurting their business. By the way, you know, if the gospel goes out, there are certain businesses that are going to suffer. If you have a revival, a genuine bona fide revival in an area where you're seeing a large percentage, might only be 10, 15, 20% of the population that are getting saved, well, there's some things that are going to happen in their lives when they become believers, things that they used to do they're not going to do anymore. You know, the song we sing in the youth group, you know, the things they used to do, don't do. Well, it's true. When you get saved, there are certain things that you used to do that you don't do them anymore. You don't drink, and you don't smoke, and you don't do some of these other things. And, you know, during the time of the great revivals in the early part of the 20th century here in the United States, the bars would shut down, not because they passed laws to shut them down, but because they ran out of customers. People stopped drinking. And so people stopped buying the shrines. So there was a lot of opposition to Paul's ministry there in the city of Ephesus. Now, he's going to change gears, and that's where our second page starts. Yes?
If I may, while we're on the general subject, looking at the diagram of the board.
The detail there, yes.
Every time I come across something like this, it always makes me marvel at the seeming coordination of churches in Paul's day. In light of ministry effort, in light of passage, taking collections. Mm-hmm. So we roll the years forward, mm-hmm. a couple thousand. All of a sudden, we have a president. in theory, it seems that people like-minded with us will accept the idea as believers, universal church. As believers of God, we are all part of the general, you know, sense of the body of Christ. And then the other aspect is the local body.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems that in practice nowadays, 2,000 years later, after the seeming ultimate scheme of coordination of churches, zero.
Okay.
Even in same denominations, zero coordination. And I just wanted to comment on that.
Okay.
If it's not too much of a digression.
Okay, let's...
But no, I know where you're coming from.
All right.
My mother-in-law has decided that she's leaving the Christian faith and becoming a Jew because no one will play nice together.
Okay, let's look at two things. Two things. Which is very much related to practice. Your doctrine and your practice. When this was written, all the churches believed the same thing. Now, culturally, the practice varied a little bit from place to place. In Jerusalem, they observed the dietary rules and so on, but they understood, they recognized the fact they didn't have to. So even the folks there in Jerusalem were on the same page as the folks in Corinth as far as their theology was concerned, and to a large extent as far as their practice was concerned. There was, like I said, you had a little bit of cultural variation from place to place, but everybody was on the same page. They were unified in doctrine, and they were unified in practice. We are not unified in doctrine or practice today. You have a huge variation today as far as what's going on. One of the things we have in our church constitution is we are not allowed, and this is a safety mechanism, we are not allowed to have somebody come in and speak in our church that is not in accord with our doctrinal statement. Is truth important?
Yes.
Absolutely. All right. There are, I do this every few years, where I go through basically an abbreviated history of the church and then deal with, in Protestantism, and I'll lump Baptists in with Protestants, in Protestantism and even within the greater evangelical umbrella, the various degrees that you have as far as what they believe. There are a lot of people that say, yes, we believe the gospel. We believe that Jesus Christ actually was born of a virgin, that he was, that he lived a perfect sinless life, that he was indeed God incarnate, that he was crucified, he was buried, rose again the third day, rose actually from the dead, ascended to heaven, and he is coming back, and yet we do not believe the Bible is without errors. There are a lot of folks that hold to that. I can't fellowship with people that hold to that. If somebody differs on something substantial doctrinally, there's a disconnect. The word fellowship means having something in common. You can't really fellowship if you don't have something in common. Now, it can be forced, and you've got a number of people that you have a big fancy word. Did I spell it right? Ecumenical.
That's a C.
Ecumenical. Which means we're going to take the Presbyterians and Lutherans and the Episcopalians and even some of the Catholics and some Seventh-day Adventists and some Baptists over here, some Methodists. We're going to take them all together and we're going to get together for some big noble cause. Well, you know, we've got some serious theological errors with some of these folks. And some of these folks aren't even believers. I get emails from an outfit here in Pierce County called Associated Ministries, which includes the Seventh-day Adventists, which includes the Presbyterians, the Methodists, some of the Baptists, Seventh-day Adventists, the Baha'i, the local Muslim group, You name it, they're in there. Big umbrella. Isn't this wonderful? No, it's horrific. I do not believe what these people believe. These folks are not in accord with the scripture. Matter of fact, most of them don't even believe it. What went for Christian 2,000 years ago was, as far as I'm concerned, what we believe. What goes for Christian today, most of them don't believe what we believe, which is why we're a congregation of 60 or 70 people. Now, this is a continuing splintering and disintegration. It's an ongoing process. Very seldom, it does happen, but very seldom do you have a group of people over here and they say, hey, you know what? You believe just like we do. And they get together and they compare notes and they said, you know, you're right. We do believe exactly what you believe. Let's get together and do something. That happens. But not too often. And part of it has to do with the fact that over time, and it's the perverse nature of humanity, we deviate from this book. We think we come up with a better idea, and we deviate from this book. You know, we might believe all of this, but, you know, we'll base something on church history. We'll base something on what some great preacher or teacher had to say to us. And so there's some deviations. And they'll base things on church history. They'll base things on any number of things. They don't go back and say we're going to believe only what the scripture has to say. The reformers had one of their calls was sola scriptura. It's the Bible only. It didn't work out that way. There were some things that they held on to that were based on tradition and on the writings of the fathers. They did not base everything solely on the scripture. And so it ends up deviating. Now, with that deviation, you can't get together on some things because there's disagreements. There's not going to be what kind of a doctrinal statement do you have? Do you have a doctrinal statement? If you don't have a doctrinal statement, then what's to keep unbelievers from participating in the ministry? You run into all kinds of issues. Now, I'm just scratching the surface on it because that's a question that has all kinds of repercussions.
It's a loaded question.
It is. And I could spend, I'm giving you a broad brushed answer. When I'm done, I'll tell you what I'll do. We've got about another 2 weeks to finish up Corinthians. And we've been on Corinthians, let's see, this was page number 72 that I printed this morning. So we've been at this for about a year and a half. When I'm done with Corinthians, then I'll chase this one. Remind me and I'll do that thing that I do every couple of years. Because it explains, I start at the beginning, what we're doing with here, and then I'll explain why is Grace Baptist Church here? And that's really the end of the question. Why is Grace Baptist Church here? Because I'll tell you right now, 20 years ago, there would be no reason for us to be here. Because there were other churches here in this town that were doing exactly what we're doing right now. You know, reason for us to be here. Yes?
And to wrap this up just a little bit for now anyway. So today, 2010, would you say, is there a need or a benefit of churches that happen to be like-minded, to be coordinated, as maybe what it seems like 2,000 years ago in Paul's day, it seems like there was a benefit and a need that same benefit/need exists today?
Yes, and we do, and our church does practice it. You might not necessarily think so, but it is. We practice it in missions. Our missionary, and I've talked to some of the other fellows in the church. There are three others I would love to take on, and when we're in a financial position to be able to do so, there's three other missionaries I'd love to take on. We are not the only supporter of the Hammonds. There's quite a few other churches. We are in a coordinated effort with like-minded churches to support the ministry of the Hammonds in Federal Way. When we have our ladies' retreat, when we have our teen retreat, when we have our men's retreat. By the way, the men's retreat is going to be in January. I strongly recommend you come. It's going to be a great time. Jeff Musgrave is going to be the speaker. It's going to be phenomenal. But that is something that is coordinated with a number of like-minded churches here in the Northwest. We do fellowship with other churches. We do now, one of the problems we have here in the Northwest is we're so far flung. It isn't like there's a church that we do things with in Tacoma, or there's a church that we do something with in Sumner, or there's one that we do something with in Graham. We're far flung. Most of the churches that we fellowship with that are connected with these ministries that I'm talking about here. Of course, the Hammonds and Federway, that's the closest. There's Galley Baptist Church in North Kent. There's Cornerstone Baptist Church in Vancouver. There's Fellowship Baptist Church in Burien. There's the church in Cedar Woolley. There's a church in Monroe. There's a church in Linwood. There's a church in Arlington. There's a church in Bellingham. There's a church in Chewila, where there's a church in Wenatchee. There's a church in Pasco. These are all churches that we fellowship with, and there's probably a few others that I haven't mentioned here in the state, and then there's a number of others, of course. And part of it is, I mentioned 20 years ago, there would be no reason for Grace Baptist Church to be here. 20 years ago, there were other churches doing what we do. There were other groups that were doing what we're doing. They've changed. And so new churches have had to have been established to do what the other churches were doing 20 years ago. And so the Northwest, now, we're an independent, unaffiliated church. In other parts of the country, there are loads of churches that do what we do. But the Northwest was left in a void because what we do here was dominated by two groups which changed. And so there was a vacuum. There was a void left. So there aren't that many of us here. But you go to other parts of the country. I mean, I grew up in the Metro Detroit area. And a church like this church, you don't have to drive more than 10 minutes anywhere in the Metro Detroit area to find a church like this church. And some of them are big. I mean, some of them have 300, 400, 500, 600 people. Churches like this church in the Metro Detroit area, you don't have to drive more than 10 minutes. For the most part, Metro Chicago area is the same way. Philadelphia is the same way. There's a number of places. Indianapolis is that way. There's a number, Wisconsin, your whole Midwest, most of your South is that way. Denver's that way, believe it or not. Denver's got a phenomenal number of great churches. But we were left with a situation here in the Northwest. So we're scattered and few and far between. It just depends on where you are nationally and even some parts of the world, other parts of the world. There's a fair number of good, sound churches. But things have changed. We are in a major state of flux right now. And things are altering. And that's why most of you are here. Because the church you used to go to, the group that you used to fellowship with, isn't what it was when you used to go. And so you're here because we are basically what you used to go to as far as doctrine and practice. Even though you may have a different background, you're here because you agree with us in doctrine and practice, because where you used to go isn't where you are here and here anymore. All right. We'll pick this up and we'll run with that a little while. We're late. Let's go ahead and close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. Father, may we be faithful. May we not deviate. May we not waver. Father, the truth of the gospel is not something that can change with the whims of culture and society. It cannot change with time. And Father, I pray that you'd help us to be faithful, to cling to the truth of your word, regardless of the pressures from without. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.